Well, why don't we get ourselves started? Yeah, I'm over here. Good evening and welcome to Holy Transfiguration Church. I'm Father Michael Butler. I'm the priest here. We have with us tonight Father Stephen Pauley of the Orthodox Christian Prison Ministry, who will make a presentation to us. A couple of housekeeping things up front. There's a bite to eat over here. The food is already blessed. Please feel free at any time, get up, help yourself, make yourself at home. Should you need a restroom, they're out that door and to the left, or through this door and to the left. And if there's anything else that you need, please let me know. And I will leave Father Stephen to introduce himself more fully. There you are, sir.
Thank you, Father. A joy to be with you tonight. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, I send you greetings from my church in Pueblo, Colorado, as well as prisoners around the United States who are praying for those who are interested in prison ministry and who have a heart for prison ministry. They care that you care. So thank you for coming tonight. I want you to know that this is a team mission. We are not out there doing this by ourselves, but it's a team. And we work together to bring the light of Christ to those living in darkness in the prisons around our country. There is an inevitable encounter that's taking place across the United States right now and in Canada. Anybody from Canada here? Yes. And in Canada, I get lots of emails and requests from Canada as well. People are either going to prison out of parishes, or they are coming out of prison and coming to parishes, and the parishes don't know what to do with them. And so it is one of those inevitable things that's happening. Now, often as I'm out speaking, I hear people say, well, not one of my people, not at my church, this isn't going to happen. And I hope you will avail yourself to a couple articles that I've written up here about little Johnny, the altar boy, who ends up going off to prison. And it's based on a true story. The fact of the matter is that the United States of America is the most incarcerated country in the world. The most incarcerated. Right now, the latest study said that 730 people out of 100,000 are in prisons in the United States. Now, that figure doesn't seem like much, but when you compare that to what's going on with other countries, Mexico, 201 out of 100,000. On down, Turkey, 168. Lebanon, 122. China, 121. Greece, 111. We're not just number one. We are the champions. We are doing it. We've managed to incarcerate more people than any other country out there. Well, what are the odds an ex-felon would come to your parish? What are the odds of that? Well, according to the National Reentry Resource Center, 708,677 people were released from state prisons and federal prisons in 1 year's time. Now, the statistics for Orthodox being in prison are somewhere between 0.5% to 1%. So I took the lowest of that. That 0.5%, if you multiply that out, approximately 3,500 Orthodox will be coming out of prison each year. Now, I was at the Assembly of Bishops. They asked me to do a presentation last September. And I was there, spoke to them for about 30 minutes. And one of the presentations that they had said that right now in the United States, there are around 1,850 parishes, Orthodox parishes. That's of all jurisdictions. Everybody combined, there's 1,850. So if you do the math, that's about two people coming out of prison each year for each parish. Now, your parish may not have been impacted yet, but the odds are that as this continues, your parish will. And every week I get calls from people saying, what do I do? You know, this guy called, he wants to come to the church on Sunday. We're not ready for that. Well, you better get ready now because it's going to happen. The odds are. Recidivism, if the parish isn't ready, odds are that little Johnny is going to go back to prison. because the parish isn't doing its job. And right now, after 3 years, the statistics show at least 4 in 10. I think after 5 years, it's more like 6 in 10 go back to prison. And the reason is simple, that they run into rejection. They don't know how to live on the outside. They get out of prison, and the first thing that happens is they go to the church rejects them. People go, I don't want that kind of person in my church. That guy was a murderer, that guy was a robber, whatever. I don't want him in my church. And they feel that, and they end up not belonging any place. I know of one story where a man got out of prison, couldn't make it, no one would accept him. He went to a jewelry store, threw a rock through the window, and stood outside and waited for the police to come. Because the only life he knew was a life inside prison. So, with that in mind, I'm going to give you all a quiz, okay? And this is, you will be graded on this. So, who would you like to welcome to your church next Sunday? I'm going to give you choices of two people, okay? First man, this handsome-looking guy who just happens to be the new parole officer in your town. He comes and he tells you that he would love to work with your children. He's been Orthodox for the last 20 years. He knows the faith. He wants to be a part of your church. You can have him, or you can have this guy. He comes to you with his Rasta dreadlocks, speaking Rastaese, and the only thing you can understand as you greet him at the door is the cuss words he's spewing out. And you're wondering, what the heck is going on? So you have a choice. You can have A or B. Who would you choose? Okay, just keep it in mind. Now, I know a lot of you are going to say B because you want to appear holy, but no. Okay, the second choice is a well-dressed businessman comes in, and he tells you that he is incredibly well-read in Orthodoxy, living a very pious lifestyle. He is very wealthy and wants to help the church grow, and he would like to be a part of your parish. So you can have him, or you can have this guy. When you greet him at the door, he just stares at you and doesn't say a word, and just continues to stare at you and never says a word as you try to greet him. Again, the choices are yours. You can have choice A or choice B. So, two of these men will be waiting at the door of your church this Sunday, and the choice is yours, who you would take. And there they are. Which two would you choose? Well, to sweeten the deal, the two guys on the A side are going to give you 10% of their income. The B side are probably going to take at least 10% of your income in your church to stick with them. So who would you choose? So before grading your quiz scores, I want to give you a couple hints to help you answer this question. Could you choose between these two at your church? If I brought in next Sunday a prostitute from your town, I don't have her picture available, but she comes to your church and wants to come in and be a part of your church. Would you rather have her, or maybe you'd rather have a saint come into your church? Would you like a saint instead of a prostitute? Well, how would it be if this lady showed up in your church? Would that be nice? Saint Mary of Egypt. Who can tell me her profession before she became a saint? Saint Mary was a prostitute. How about between these two? You could have a murderer and a robber, and the police wouldn't give me his picture either. Or, you could have a saint come to your church. How about this man, Saint Moses of Ethiopia? Before he became the abbot of a monastery and a holy martyr for the faith, he was a murderer and a robber. The point I'm trying to get at is that hostile and unlovely people can and do become saints. And as Orthodox Christians, we need to begin to see people not as they are, but as they could become through the Holy Orthodox Faith. We need to see them as God sees them. And that's whether we're working with people in prison or people that just happen to wander into our church. We need to see them as God sees them, as people in need, not as, oh my gosh, what is that guy doing in my church? I was telling the clergy earlier today, a couple months ago, I had a guy come in the middle of our ortho service in the morning before Divine Liturgy, and he comes walking in with no shirt, no shoes, and he's got 666 tattooed across his heart. And I went out, I had my chanter continue the service, and I said, how you doing? He goes, oh, I got beat up. They stole my shirt. They stole my shoes. Can you help me? And I said, of course we can. You look hungry. Can we feed you? So I went over and I made him a sandwich, turkey sandwich, gave him a soda pop and chips, and he sat outside and ate his breakfast, and we ran and got a shirt for him, and I loved it. My deacon's wife went and got a shirt, and the shirt, first she gave him a t-shirt, and it said, I eat healthy, I eat organic. I said, you couldn't have picked a greater shirt. And then on top of that, a Hawaiian shirt to go over the top of that, along with some shoes and socks. So he was in business. But the key there is not to see somebody as, oh my gosh, what is this guy doing in my church? But to look at it as an opportunity to love somebody. And who knows what God might do in their life. So each of these picks represents, now these aren't actual picks of people in prison, but they represent the people I'm going to tell you about in a little while. The same person. So, let me back up and tell you how this all started. Unlikely beginnings. In my early days, my life was going to be spent in the outdoors. My major in college was wildlife biology. And I went to work for the Forest Service and became a smoke jumper out of Missoula, Montana, parachuting into fires to fight forest fires. And little did I know, or any of my smoke jumping buddies at that time, little did they know, that I would end up eventually going into ministry. But God called me to jump into a different kind of fire. And I believe I could rightly describe it as the fires of hell within a prison. And I began parachuting into prisons, kind of. So how this all happened, I had the opportunity to apply to become a chaplain. And I filled out my application, had a blessing to do this, and filled out my application. I gave it to my wonderful wife to proofread. And she started laughing. And I said, what are you laughing about? I said, this is serious. Now, I had never been in a prison in my life. But the opportunity was there. I thought I would test the waters and see. And she said, if you're going to apply to be a chaplain, you ought to at least spell it correctly. I was applying to be Charlie Chaplin in the prison. And I didn't think they would like that. So that tells you how much I knew about being a chaplain. I didn't even know how to spell it correctly. So eventually, I received word that I had been hired, and I was excited because they were going to train me up to be a chaplain, and I was ready to be trained. I wanted to know all about it, and I walked in that first morning to the warden's office and introduced myself and stood up from behind his desk, and he walks around and he shakes my hand and he says, welcome, chaplain. Go do what chaplains do. And he turned around and walked away. And I thought, Lord, I have no idea what chaplains do. And so I headed out onto the prison yard for the first time in my life, not knowing what in the world I was going to experience. And as I was walking across the prison yard, fervently saying the Jesus prayer, I looked up ahead, and there leaned up against the wall were two of the biggest human beings I'd ever seen in my life. Their arms were bigger than my legs. And they were staring at me. And I thought, I bet they killed the chaplain. That's why they're here. And I thought to myself, I'm going to go look at that side of the yard first. And I turned and started to walk away from those guys. And you know how sometimes you have that still, small voice deep inside that speaks to you. And I could hear it clear as anything. That's not why I've called you here. So with all the courage I could conjure up inside myself, I went over to those two chaplain killers, and I stuck out my hand and I introduced myself, and to my great surprise, they broke into big smiles. And they said, "We are so glad you're here, chaplain. We need you so desperately on this yard." And that was my first interaction with somebody in prison. And I realized from that moment on that the missing ingredient in prison is really love. That these men that I would be serving, it's now, that was in January, last week in fact, January of 1985, 30 years later, I'm standing before you. And I can tell you that that's what was missing in lots of men's lives. One of those guys actually became a regular in our chapel service. I remember one day I was walking by the weight pile. You know, these guys are out there working out with weights. And a bunch of the guys began to harangue me. They're going, "Chaplain, how come you don't come up here and work out with weights with us?" And this big guy walked over and he put his arm around me and he goes, "Chap don't need to. He's got me." Everybody went back to working out with weights. So that was my introduction. So what took place from there? Oh, I'm going to go back to our story with these men. I'd been a chaplain for about 10 years, and things had been going really, really well. I was actually doing Orthodox services in Spanish, and as well as English, and the chapel was packed out at this prison. I had been at this particular prison for 4 years. Things were going really well. And I had the same warden for all those 4 years. And he was a good Southern Baptist deacon. And as a good Southern Baptist, he would call no man father. But he used to always call me son. And so one day I'm walking past his office, and I hear his voice ring out, "Son, y'all come in here. I want to talk to you." And he was from Alabama. That was my best Alabama I can do. And so I went into his office. I said, "Yes, sir. What can I do for you?" And he said, "Son, they're building this here supermax prison up in Colorado." And he said, "It's going to be an ugly place." He said, "There's going to be people trying to harm each other." He said, "There'll likely be killings in the prison." He said, "I've worked in those kind of prisons before." He said, his words, he said, "There'll be times when there's blood rolling down the hallways." And then he looks at me and he said, "Son, I think God's calling you up there." I said, "Excuse me, sir?" And he goes, no, now hear me out. He said, "I've watched you for 4 years." And he said, "I think with the gifts that God's given you," he said, "I think that would be a good place for you to be." And so I said, "Well, sir, with all due respect, I'll pray about this." So he said, "Son, you don't need to pray. You just tell me. I'm going to make it happen." I said, "No, I'm going to go pray." So this was on a Friday. So I went home to my lovely, well-founded wife, and I told her all the bad stuff. And she told me later, she said, at first, about 30 seconds of fear just went running through her body. And then she said, just this peace came over her. And she looked at me and she said, "I think it's the Lord." And I thought, what do wives know? I called my spiritual father on the phone. Surely there's a voice of reason out there. So I even exaggerated how bad it would be with my spiritual father. He said the same thing. He said, "It's the Lord. You need to go." And so that next Monday, I went to my warden and I opened his door a crack. I stuck my head in and I quoted Isaiah. I said, "Here am I, send me." And he pounded his desk. He goes, "That's all I need to hear." And sure enough, a few months later, I got a call from the warden up in Colorado. And he said, he didn't have an Alabama accent, but he said, "You know, I'm sitting here looking at Pikes Peak and it's got snow all over the top of it." And he said, "How'd you like to come up here and see that site?" And I said, "I'd love to." And so in 1994, before this prison ever opened, I moved my family. I have 4 children. And we all moved to Colorado to a place I'd never been, and we started a ministry there. These next stories are from that. And when I got there, I actually arrived in July of 1994. We didn't receive any men until November, and so I had plenty of time to get prepared, and I went around secretly, as a chaplain can do, blessing the place, praying over the cells, praying for peace in that place, because I knew that we were going to get, as they described it, the worst of the worst coming to this particular place. So the first man that I gave you a choice of looked a bit like the guy on the right there when I first met him, and I would make rounds through the entire place every week, see the men every week. And in the course of those rounds, I would always have to go, and there's two doors, one a solid steel door, and then there's bars on the other side of that where you step in. And I would open the outer door and step in and talk to each man in that place. And this particular guy would always be yelling at me. And he would be yelling in Rastaese, I called it. And all I could understand was when he would be cussing at me. And I could never figure out what he was. I would say, I don't quite understand. And he would start cussing some more. Well, one of the men who had already become Orthodox in the prison, this man was actually studying to be a Buddhist monk. And he was transferred over and to the cell beside this guy. He started talking to him about Orthodoxy. And the guy got really interested, started reading all kinds of books. And lo and behold, unbelievable, he changed his whole demeanor. And he began to actually love the priest. And he was one of the few men that would get out of that place. And when he got out, he was going to St. Louis. And he said, I need help finding a church. And so we located a church, and he went it was a Greek church in St. Louis, and they welcomed him with open arms. They opened, so unbelievable. The church called me months later, and the lady who ran their church school said, Father, we absolutely love this man. It's incredible. We have him working with our youth. We have him serving in the altar. It's just incredible. And he's right here with me. They call me at my office at the prison, and I'm going to put him on the phone with you. He gets on the phone with me, and he says, Father, he said, this place loves me. And he said, they trust me. And I said, of course they trust you. And he goes, no, you don't understand. They really, truly trust me. He said, they hired me to be the janitor and the helper around the church. He said the women's group was having a meeting downstairs in the basement, and they had a luncheon, and I served their lunch, and it was time for them to pray. And he said all the women got up and went upstairs to the church to pray. And he said as I was bussing the tables, I looked around, and every single woman left her purse on the table. Now that probably doesn't mean anything to you, but to a guy who's come out of the most maximum secure prison in the United States, that meant everything. Well, that's not the end of the story. This story goes on with this young man. He also told me on the phone, he goes, I can't mess up in here. He goes, they know who I am. He said, I'm the only African-American man in this church. He said, so when I walk in, they know who I am. And so the church, again, embraced him, and they said, we think you ought to go to college. He'd never been. And they set it up, paid for him to go to a junior college. After 1 year at a junior college, he did so well, a local university offered him a scholarship. The church helped pay for everything else. The university wasn't paying for. He went there. In 4 years' time, I received an invitation to his graduation, receiving his bachelor's degree. Guess what he majored in? Criminal justice, right, sister? Criminal justice, unbelievable. The church wasn't satisfied. They said, we think you should continue on and get a master's degree. 2 years later, this young man, I got a picture from the church of this young man with two judges, one on each side of him with their arms around him, he in his cap and gown, all of them with big smiles as he received his master's degree in criminal justice. And I'm not sure how this worked out because he'd committed a federal crime, done time in a federal prison, but somehow they helped him to become a federal probation officer. And in 2013, I believe it was, I may have the date wrong, but he was invited to come to the White House to explain why his probation program was the best in the United States. That is a success story, incredible story of what God can do in someone's life. If we can just look past the exterior, maybe at the start, and see the person that could be in there. The second man, now this prison also had all the major gangs in it. Not the gangs, the leaders of the gang. And this particular man came into the prison, one of the leaders of a particular notorious gang. And I made my rounds, and when I showed up to see this man, this is what I got. And he would just stand there and stare at me. Well, I thought, that's okay. I always called him by name and gave him my little newsletter or whatever I was handing out. And this went on and on and on. 2 years. He never said a word to me for 2 years. Never a word. And after 2 years' time, I got used to it. You know, I figured, oh, hi, how you doing today? Here's a little newsletter for you. He broke the silence. And he said, Father, do you have anything I can read about your faith? I said, yeah, I've got all kinds of stuff you can read. I'll send you something. So I went back and thought, what do I send this guy? I sent him The Way of the Pilgrim. And he sent it back to me, said, I loved it. Send me another book. And it started him on the path to orthodoxy. And I had the chance to bring him into the faith. Probably the most brilliant man I've ever met in my life, inside or outside of prison. You'll forgive me, I'm going to reveal my ignorance here, Father, but I don't know how many of you have ever read Losky's Mystical Theology. I read Losky's Mystical Theology a paragraph at a sitting, and then I go, what the heck did he just say? He read Losky's Mystical Theology twice in a week, gave it back to me and said, we need to sit down and discuss this. Lord have mercy, this guy is racing on. But incredible. And the reason I tell his story is to point out to you that wherever you are, it's not just in a prison, wherever you are, in your workplace, whatever you're doing, there are people around you who know that you're an Orthodox Christian. And as an Orthodox Christian, you have a responsibility to make sure that they see an Orthodox Christian. They don't need to see the rest of the world in us. They need to see Christ in us. I asked this man, after he had become Orthodox, I said, so what was up with just staring at me for 2 years? And he said, I was just watching you. And I said, for 2 years? He said, Father, that's nothing. He goes, guys in here. He said, they'll watch you for 10 years. They just want to see if you're for real. And he said, you know, I would listen as you made rounds down my range. And he said, I would hear guys just screaming and yelling and cussing at you. And I would always listen to see how you were going to respond. And he said, every single time over the last 2 years, he said, you spoke loving, kind, soft words to them and brought them back down. And he said, after 2 years, he said, I wanted what you had. And that is not me, that's the Lord. But I think it shows you how people do watch. And even if we don't realize it, we are being witnesses for the Lord. I want to share some more stories with you. One of the perks of being a priest, especially I serve a Greek parish, one year I was invited to go over to Greece to the summer camp over there, Ionian Village, and serve at Ionian Village as a priest. And I asked the warden, and he graciously gave me enough time off to go do that. And while we were there, we would take the kids to different places. And we had like 200 kids with us. And one of our trips was to Osios Lukas, that's Blessed Luke Monastery. It's a beautiful monastery there in Greece. And we were going to do Vespers that evening. And so we had 200 kids in the main church of the monastery. And it was still about 20 minutes till Vespers. And I thought, Lord, I just need a couple minutes of peace and quiet. And so I slipped out by myself. And on the lower right, you see their small chapel at Osios Lukas Monastery. And I went in, and for some reason, I just went before the royal doors. And I just prostrated myself before the doors and started praying. And when I looked up, there, right in the center of the royal doors, was a face of a man back in that prison in Colorado. And I could see it just as clearly as I'm looking at you, Father. I could see his face. And of course, my first words to the Lord, breaking my prayer, was, "Why him, Lord? He's not even interested in Orthodoxy." And of course, God said nothing. He was totally silent. And so I pondered this. I didn't know why I had seen this man. So I went back, and it actually took me a couple weeks to work up the courage to even tell him. And finally, I stopped by his cell one day, and I said, "You know, I've got to tell you something." And I said, "This is what happened." I told him the whole story. His eyes got big, and he stepped back, and he said, "Why me?" I said, "That's the same question I ask." I said, "I don't know why you." But I said, "You know, I've got some reading material on Blessed Luke, Osios Lukas." And I said, "Would you like to read about him?" And lo and behold, that started him on a journey to Orthodoxy. And when he was baptized, he took the name Lukas. Incredible. God loves these guys enough to reach out all the way over on the other side of the world to show me a man that wasn't even talking to me about anything of matters of the faith. And that man becomes Orthodox. Well, one of the things that happened, Metropolitan Isaiah, who is the Greek metropolitan for the Denver metropolis, which is a huge metropolis, he would come twice a year to pay pastoral visits at the prison. We had a number of guys become Orthodox there, quite a lot. And he would come and he would visit every single man. He would serve them communion. And we would talk. And it would take all day to go through the prison and visit all these men. And so he had been doing this for quite some time. And one time after his visit, he said, "So, Father Stephen," he always talks like that. He goes, "Father Stephen, have you ever thought about tonsuring any of these men as monastics?" I said, "I have never thought of that. I can tell you right now, I've never thought of that." He goes, and his words, "Some of these men, their prayer life puts me to shame." I said, "We should think about it." So the next time I saw Metropolitan Isaiah, he was paying a pastoral visit to my church. And the first thing he says, he doesn't greet me, he doesn't say anything. He says, "So have you thought any more about tonsuring any of those men?" And I started laughing. I said, I have. And I said, "I don't see how it could work. You know, they can't live together. There could be no community." I don't see how it could work. And he said, "I've got it all figured out." He said, "I'm going to be the abbot of the monastery, and you're going to be their spiritual father." He said, "On my next visit, you decide who should be tonsured, and I'll tonsure them." So I went, "Oh, Lord, what do I do?" You know, and I went back and really started praying about what we should set down as criteria for men to be tonsured in a prison, because it was going to be a whole different thing. It wasn't going to be monasticism as we know monasticism on the outside. It was going to be a whole different experience. And so I thought, well, these men can never get out of prison because it wouldn't be fair to torture them inside a prison and then have them come back out into the world. So it would have to be people who were eventually going to die in prison. And then it would have to be men, obviously, who were leading that pious life. One of the things that we give away for free to anyone who contacts us from prison is our Orthodox prayer book. And this book covers all the prayers through the whole day. A number of these men were praying every prayer in this book every day. And they would faithfully get up at midnight and pray the midnight service. Even though they didn't have to get up at exactly at midnight, they did. And they would start prayer first thing in the morning. And they would pray all the prayers in this book every day. And so we looked at that and finally decided that five of the men could be tonsured. And Metropolitan Isaiah ended up tonsuring five of these men. The way that the prison is set up, there are ranges, and there's two stories to it. There's a range down here and a range up above it. And in order to talk to each other, the men would get on the phone with each other. And to get on the phone, they would take a roll of toilet paper, put it over the drain of their shower, and blow the water out of the drain. And then they would talk through the drain to anybody they wanted to talk to. Well, you can imagine it's not exactly a private line. And knowledge in prison is power. And so, you know, everybody listens in to everybody else's phone call. I would be making my rounds. Sometimes I'd come up, and the guy would be on his hands and knees in the shower. He'd go, "Oh, Father, just a second. Hey, Father's here. I got to go. I'll talk to you later." He goes, "Sorry, I was on the phone." And that's just the way they looked at it. So two of the men who had been tonsured as monastics are living on the same, one downstairs, one upstairs. And they're on the phone with each other. Great Lent is approaching, and they're getting all excited. They said, "Oh my gosh, Great Lent is coming." And every year at Great Lent, they had been so blessed with what God had done in their lives. And they were excited. They were excited. They were talking about, they made a plan to read through the entire New Testament once a week. And I said, "Well, I'll join you guys." I didn't even make it through the Gospel of Matthew, but they succeeded. They had their reading plan, and every week through Great Lent, they read the entire New Testament. Well, they're talking about all this, and they're talking about fasting. And they started talking about fasting and how God blesses them when they fast, and they were all excited. Well, as I said, it's not a private line, and so there's a man listening in who knew nothing about Orthodoxy, absolutely nothing, had never talked to me about Orthodoxy, but he's listening in, and as he's listening in, he starts getting excited about all that God has blessed these guys with, and he thinks, "Well, God will bless me, I'm going to fast." But he doesn't know how Orthodox fast. So come the first day of Great Lent, he stops eating everything. And for 3 days, he eats nothing. Eats absolutely no food whatsoever. The next day, I come by on my rounds. I stop to see one of the guys, one of the monastic guys, and he says, "Father, you better go see so-and-so up there." This is a very monastic term. He's tripping out up there. So I said, "I'll go see him." And so I go up, and I start talking to him, and he says, "This is what happened." He said, I quit eating everything. And he said, on the third night, he said, in the middle of the night, he said, "I woke up. And there at the foot of my bed," he said, "there was," his words, he said, "there was a lady, bright, shining, white. And she had a baby in her arms. And she called me by name, and she held out the baby and said, 'Take my baby.'" And here's this big thug. He said, "I got so scared, I threw the covers over my head and I turned to the wall. And when I peeked out, she was gone." The next night, the same thing happened. Middle of the night, bright, shining white lady calls him by name, holds out her baby and says, "Take my baby." The next night, three nights in a row, I'm making it very Orthodox, three nights in a row it happened. Well, I'm listening to this story, and he says, what do you think it means? And I said, well, you know, I'm not an interpreter of visions or dreams. I said, but it sounds to me like the mother of our Lord is telling you, you need to commit your life to her son, Jesus Christ. And he looks at me and he goes, I thought it might be something like that. And I said, but you know what? Tomorrow, I said, amazingly, tomorrow, there is someone coming who's much wiser than me, and he should be able to explain it to you much better than I can. I said, he's the bishop of our church, Metropolitan Isaiah. He's coming on a visit, and I'll bring him by to see you. And so he was all excited. And so when Metropolitan Isaiah showed up, I told him what had happened. And he goes, well, let's go see him first. And so we went off to see this man. And so Metropolitan Isaiah is at the bars. I'm standing beside him, ready to take in all the wisdom that ushers forth from his lips. And the man tells the whole story. Metropolitan Isaiah is there, and he's nodding. And I'm waiting. The story's over, and I'm waiting. And he suddenly turns to me, and he says, baptize him. I said, Your Eminence. I said, he's not a catechumen. He doesn't know anything about orthodoxy. And he said, it doesn't matter. God has spoken. When God speaks like this, you catechize, or you baptize, and then you catechize. And so that's exactly what we did. And it takes a while to get a baptism set up in a prison setting. So a couple of weeks later, we baptized him. And I think one of his first lessons might have been on fasting as an Orthodox. But, so that was his story. And again, just to show how much God cares about people that we often view as unlovely. And sometimes I've even heard people talk about them being trash and how much God loves them. Well, when we visit someone in prison, the whole church visits. You know, not everybody in the church can go to prison and visit somebody. But when even one of us goes, the whole church goes. Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the earth. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. We do that pretty well, don't we? I don't know if you're all involved with local soup kitchens or things like that, but Orthodox churches around the country tend to do a good job with feeding the hungry. Thirsty, and you gave me drink. We take care of that. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Naked, and you clothed me. Sick, and you visited me. Those first five, I would say the Orthodox Church gets an A, or an A+. It's this last one. As I've traveled around the country, I've noticed that the Orthodox Church is not involved. In fact, they don't want to be involved in some cases. They're not doing anything. And when I talk to people about it, they go, well, that's not for our church. You don't understand, Father. My people aren't, you know, we're just not into that kind of thing. Well, I'm sorry, but there was this thing Jesus said about the sheep and the goats. I really want to be numbered with the sheep. I really do. What could OCPM and you do together? Well, this is what OCPM is currently doing. We're working within all jurisdictions in a truly pan-Orthodox manner, ministering to men and women who are in prison or who have recently been released. Many embrace the faith while they're in prison, and then they come back to churches. There are currently hundreds of Orthodox catechumens in jails and prisons. And our correspondence department is sending out literally thousands of letters, thousands of books, studies, icons. The things you see up here, everything we have, we give freely to anybody in prison. We just send it to them when they request it. We're busy training clergy and lay people across the country to meet the needs of those in prison and coming out of prison. That's part of what we are doing today with the clergy here, was to just try and encourage the clergy. Not that your clergy didn't need any encouragement, But a lot of clergy do across the United States, to get involved and not be afraid of that. Many of the people in prison have been touched by OCPM. They're now out of prison, leading productive, Christ-centered lives as active members in their local parishes. As I said, we're over 1 million now and still going. 2 million icon prayer cards have been printed and distributed. And I've got some of those cards for you up here tonight. And believe it or not, in this United States of America, there are still state systems who do not recognize the Eastern Orthodox religion as a viable religion. My mind is blown at times. You know, they don't recognize orthodoxy. And so when someone comes in and says, I'm Orthodox, they don't even have a category for that. And they put them down as something else. A lot of times our Orthodox people get lost. They're listed as Jewish, or they're listed as Catholic, or they're listed as Protestant. And they're lost in the system. So it's a difficult thing that we're working with. The books that I have up here, I also put on the screen here. These are books, some of the books that we have. We have a lot more now that we're using. This last book, an incredible study on that St. John did. St. John Chrysostom wrote a treatise called a treatise to prove that no one can harm the man that doesn't harm himself. And I did some study questions with that. I found it to be perhaps the best study I had done in prison with the men because their lives were so broken. But we've also used it with a lot of churches, and people have been writing me regularly telling me how much St. John's words have blessed them. So we're doing that. We've got the pamphlets that you see up here, some of the pamphlets, Prayers for Today, and then Battling Evil Thoughts. This just came from my own experience of hearing confessions in prison and then guys coming back and saying, why am I still having evil thoughts? I confessed it. Why am I still battling this? And just the whole idea that we don't just simply confess once and, you know, it's not like a magic wand and it's gone. But this is a continual battle that we have. We've got lots of different icons. And if you go to our website, you can see that. And like I said, everything is given out for free. The men will take icons and make a little iconostasis for themselves where they pray. And that's been real effective. So if I could at this time, could we stop the video? And that would be great. I want to share just a little bit more that shouldn't be videotaped, just because of privacy issues and whatnot. I think this is the part where it comes up. I wanted to show you a baptism in prison, and that's why I didn't want it videotaped, because it shouldn't be. We had permission to take this picture, but at the same time, I didn't want it out on the internet. This is what a baptism looks like in a maximum security prison. You can see the man who's about to be baptized. If you look closely, all those black marks are tattoos all over him. He's got handcuffs on. He actually has leg irons on. Father Dwayne Peterson, every single man that I baptized, I would call Father Dwayne. And Father Dwayne's been in prison ministry and street ministry for over 50 years now. And so I would call him over in California. And as soon as he would hear my voice, he goes, so how soon do I need to be there? And I would say, well, here's the date for the baptism. And he would come over. And he was the godfather for every single person that we baptized at this prison. And you can see my holy baptismal tank there. I bought it down at the Holy Feed Store. And it works very, very well. My goal was to make sure that when I baptized these men, that they truly got every piece of their body underwater. I wanted the waters of the Jordan to wash over them. And I was telling the clergy earlier today, one of the men from the time we started the prayers of exorcism, and we began leading him after that to the baptismal tank, he just started a gut-wrenching weeping, and he wept through his entire baptism. I mean, it was so moving. He couldn't stop. It was just, his whole body was weeping, and it was just an incredible, incredible time. It made me realize just how powerful baptism is. You see him receiving Holy Chrism down in the bottom left, and then receiving Holy Communion for the first time. That's a little portable iconostasis that I had, and we had a little candle we'd put in front of it, and you know, we tried to make it as nice as possible for a man being baptized. So, one of the men I wanted to talk to you about that I didn't want filmed, when he came to this prison, this man, we had a special meeting of the security staff. And the security staff said, "This is the most violent man yet to come to this prison." At the previous prison he was at, he grabbed the sink and tore it off his wall and took this sink and beat a hole through the concrete wall into the adjoining cell. They said, "He is so dangerous, we don't want anyone to get close to him, stay back from him." At the same time, the warden had already told me, "As a chaplain, you can do whatever you want. You want us to open all the doors and you go in and sit on the bunk and pray with somebody, we'll do that." And so my first interaction with this man, I went up to his cell, and he arrived at the prison. No sooner did he arrive than he sent me a note telling me that he was going to sue me because I didn't have white supremacist videos on our closed circuit TV. Now, one of the things we did there, and I need to give Sister great credit here, when I opened this place, they gave me a very nice budget and said I could do anything I wanted. And so I set up closed circuit television from the chaplain's office. And I had a whole rack of VCRs, and we could pop these VCRs in, and even had a computerized thing that would play them 24 hours a day. Would actually rewind the VCRs or the videos and play them over and over again. And I had 8 videos, VCRs, that I could play over a 24-hour period. And Sister, I ordered every Firebird video that they had, I think, at the time. And they saw all of those, and those videos were a great help in winning a lot of those men over. One of the things I would also do is I would take a camera, video camera, and I would go out once a month. I would always videotape something every week. I'd usually take it to my church, videotape Divine Liturgy, and the men could join us for Divine Liturgy. But once a month, I promised them I would take them outdoors in Colorado. And for 2 hours, I would take them hiking, and then I would set up maybe by a stream or on a stump or on a rock, and I would videotape. And I told the men, "Whatever happens on these trips, you will see. I won't ever edit anything." So one day, I'm up on top of a cliff. There's this rock spire, and I climbed up on top, and I showed the men what we were going to be filming from. You know, here's this rock spire going 80 feet up in the air. And so I climbed up there and had the camera set up, and I'm filming, and just as I start filming, a gust of wind comes up and blows the camera, tripod and all, and it does a dart 80 feet down into the rocks and totally shatters. And so actually, the film was okay, and I showed the film to the men. They got a big laugh out of that, and your tax money bought me another video camera, so it was great. So anyway, with that said, he was going to sue me. So I went up to see him, hadn't met him yet, and he's standing at the back of his cell, and he's looking at me, and I come in, and I put my hands through the bars, and I said, "Come on over here, look closer so we can talk." And so he slowly came over, and as he came, I reached out and I took both his hands in my hands, and I just started talking to him. And he told me later, he said, that was the first time in 5 years that anyone had touched him outside of putting restraints on him. And it began a spiritual relationship with that young man. And eventually, he began to read Orthodox books. And then when he became Orthodox, after he had become Orthodox, he asked me, because we were showing a lot of iconography kind of videos, and he asked me if he could try to do an icon. Now, at this time in the prison, they allowed him to have a pencil about this big and white paper, and that was it, because they were afraid he would, anything bigger, he would make a weapon out of it. And so I didn't mean to have all that in there, but I used to have three choices for you, and I narrowed it to two because I wanted to show this at the end tonight. This was one of his first icons that he did with just a pencil and white paper, St. Anthony the Great. And for a long time, he just did pencil icons. St. John the Theologian. And then the administration began to realize that he was becoming a model prisoner. And in fact, the head of security came to me one day and he said, "Chap, what did you do to inmate so-and-so?" His words, he said, "He's gone from being an absolute animal to an absolute angel." And I said, "I didn't do anything, God did." And he looks at me and he goes, "Yeah, right, chap." He goes, "Whatever you did to him, would you go do it to the rest of these guys in here?" And, but they, because of that, they began to allow him more privileges. And so they allowed him to get chalk. And I said, "Wow, you're going to do some chalk icons?" He goes, No. He goes, "I've got a plan." He goes, "I want paint." And so he took the chalk and he ground it into a powder. He added toothpaste. And then he added a drop of garlic oil. And I said, "What's with the garlic oil?" He goes, "Trust me, I need the garlic oil in there. It helps the paint." But then he didn't have paintbrushes because they wouldn't allow him to have paintbrushes. And so he plucked the hairs out of his head. And I looked, and there he had them all lined up on his little table in his cell. He had everything from a one-hair brush up to thick brushes from the hairs of his head. And he began to use this to do icons. And I just have one to show you tonight, but that was one of his early attempts with his chalk that he did. Well, eventually, the prison allowed him to have paint. And you'd thought he'd just gone to heaven. And they allowed him to have brushes. And so he did this icon, and this icon was a special one that he did of him in his cell, writing an icon. And you can see the angel on his shoulder telling him how to write the icon. You can see he's dressed as a monastic. That's not prison garb, but it's an icon. So you have to understand that everything is symbolic in there. And he's got a prayer rope that he's praying the Jesus prayer as he's doing the icon. And then you see the demons down below shooting arrows at him. Some of the demons have been slain by God's angels. Some of the arrows from the demon are sticking in him. Some have bounced off. The angels are doing battle. You see the divine ladder of ascent, the ladder of divine ascent, stretching up, and Christ waiting at the top for him to make his journey. And you see the fires of hell leaping up from his cell, seeking to devour him. Now, opening up to his cell, I had told the men that when they prayed, when they used our prayer book and they were praying the prayers of the day, that they were joining with people around the world. Orthodox were praying these same prayers. And I would tell them, the monks on Mount Athos are praying with you at the same time. And so this is his depiction of Mount Athos breaking into his cell and how his prayers and their prayers are becoming one. And you notice there's a little bird sitting on the concrete in between the two that's flying back and forth, taking their prayers. The petals of some flowers are draped over, and the petals are falling, and the red flower petals are falling, and as the petals fall, when they hit the floor of his cell, they become the blood of Christ. The blood of Christ is running down, extinguishing the fires of hell. Pretty remarkable icon. And those are some of the other icons that he had opportunity to do. So, with that, I will be glad to take any questions you might have. Anything that, that you would like. Yes? Well,
I couldn't hear what she said.
She said, why did the people who were tonsured have to be in prison the rest of their life? That was a decision that I made because I felt that it wasn't right, because they weren't going to experience monasticism in a monastic community. They were experiencing monasticism on their own. And for someone to get out of prison and then go to a community, it would be a really awkward thing. They might not be accepted by the community. It could end up being disastrous for them. So if men were getting out of prison, I would always tell them, you know, if you want to be a monastic, then wait until you get out of prison and give it some time, a year at least of being out, and then go to a monastery and try it out and see what you think. So that was the reason why. Other questions, or you can ask me anything. Yes?
Do you have women going to, obviously women are in prison, do you have any type of ministry?
We do, and right now one of the ministries I'm really excited about is our correspondence ministry. And because we only have men from our correspondence team, I thought we should have women writing women. And so we've started this correspondence program, and it is. I was talking to a priest where my pilot program of a church, and he was saying, wow, he said, it's so fantastic. He said, these ladies just absolutely love the ministry. And all the mail comes to the church. We have very strict guidelines for the correspondence and ministry. And so he gets to see all the letters that come in. He doesn't open them, he said, but he knows who's getting mail from different ones in prison. And, you know, we've got women in as far away as Alaska writing down, New Jersey, Texas, all over the United States. Women that are involved with writing someone on the outside. So
how do you get involved with
that? You have to come through me. If you're interested, the guidelines I use is, first and foremost, you have to have a blessing from your priest.
Okay.
Second, your priest has to agree to go over the training manual with you and sign off on the training manual.
Okay.
I require everyone to sign off on it and say, absolutely, I will abide by the rules that are laid down in this training manual, because it's serious business. And, you know, I was telling the clergy earlier today, you know, I know of one man who, you know, it seems innocent. You know, the person writing you says, could you please send me just $5 a month for stamps? And you go, $5 a month, I could do that. And you send $5 a month. Well, one guy I know had 100 people sending him $5 a month. That was a pretty good deal.
But if you know, you are supposed to go and have their number and put $5, and they just give the stamps. I had a son-in-law in prison, so you don't just send them money.
Well, you depends on the system. No, you don't send them money. You send it to be put on their books.
Yeah.
But they can use it for anything.
Well, in Michigan, anyways.
Yeah.
You can't ever just send them money.
You send it to their account,
right, their
and
account.
And then they have so much money, and they can spend it on whatever they want in prison. They don't have to spend it on stamps.
Not in Michigan.
Really? Well, that might be a different system.
Yeah.
Our rule, though, is very strict. Yeah. Never allowed to send money, period.
Yeah, you can't.
Zero. You can't.
In the Michigan prison system, if they want stamps, they only get stamps. And then you can send them a pack of stuff, and you select exactly what they're going to get. Coffee, salt and peppers. I know. My son-in-law is in prison. So.
Well, that's good. At the same time, games could still be played with that. You know.
Well, after they get it, they can trade.
Exactly.
They can trade.
Stuff. It's not just trading. In prison, you know, a lot of gambling goes on. They gamble with their commissary.
Yeah.
You know, they place bets on football games, and they can buy other things as well,
right,
that aren't good.
Maybe drugs or something.
Yeah. Yes.
If you become a in prison volunteer in Michigan, you're banned from all of that. You can't buy Michigan packages with coffee or whatever, and you can't send money, and you'll be terminated by the state.
Typically, you're not allowed, and in most systems, you're not allowed to have any other contact, writing letters or phone calls. You're not, as a volunteer, you're not allowed any of that.
You can buy books like through Amazon or
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can't send the books. You can only have Barnes and Noble or something like that.
Right, there's recognized publishers is what it is, Sister?
Two things. The first, or are you aware that Michigan had not recognized Orthodox until a few years ago? And one of our Orthodox priests had been in Grand Rapids at the time.
Father Andrew.
Was working with.
Father Andrew Lowe?
Yes.
Yeah, I know him very well. Yep.
Yeah, and he was able to work in with Father Norman to get that reversed, so that Father Norman could initiate getting the prison industry going in Michigan.
Right.
The other thing, a week or so ago, I was watching a DVD. It was like the 30th anniversary of the program being made. They were interviewing one of the actresses and asking her, what she was doing now and about her life and career. And she said that the most important, significant work that she's ever done, not as acting in big name films, but in England, they started a kind of a prison ministry where they went in and taught the men to act.
To act.
And that they unleashed incredible skills, and that they would perform Shakespeare. And I think they, and it became a very big thing. And she said that has meant more to her than anything else in her life in terms of being successful.
This isn't exactly Orthodox, but one of the things I did early in my chaplaincy was I thought about that very thing, and I bought a bunch of those big puppets. And I told the men, this was at a medium secure prison, and I said, can you guys build a stand? And so they built this elaborate two-story puppet show kind of thing. And we started once a week putting on puppet shows. And then the warden liked it so much that he said, I've decided to have a Christmas program where the men can have their families come into the visitation room, and he said, you can set up and have a puppet show with the men and their families. And so, it was tremendous. We did this very elaborate puppet show. We had all their kids and wives there, and it was really tremendous, really tremendous. So, they're very creative, very, very wonderful.
I know that it's not directly promoting Orthodoxy, but it is the kind of thing that maybe possibly in the future, whether it's music or acting or some kind of a skill, to give to help give a more meaning to the men's lives. It's mostly men we're talking of, but men or women, to help them gain more self-respect, it's the same kind of a thing that you have, sometimes you have movies about in some schools that everybody flunks everything and drops out of school and violence and everything, that some gifted teacher goes in, and whether it's to teach them to play chess or to play musical instruments or sing or whatever the act or whatever.
I think it touches deep inside them and makes them feel human again. So it's a wonderful thing.
It helps you nurture the whole person.
Yeah. Thank you, Sister. Bob?
Yes, Father, one of the hardest things with prison ministry, and I know you have to be patient and plan, but getting into prisons and getting to that point where we, you know, feel we're, you know, actually benefiting prisoners. What advice do you have for us here in Michigan going about that?
One of the things we can do is I can get you in touch with our correspondence ministry, and if there's people contacting us from Michigan, we can let you know, and then we can contact them and say, you know, we've got a group that are very interested in beginning Orthodox services. If you'd like this, then you need to make sure that your religious preference is Eastern Orthodox, and then make a formal request to the chaplain to have Eastern Orthodox services at your prison, and then have the chaplain contact OCPM, and we'll put him in touch with, you know, your priest. And it's always better from the inside. It's very, very difficult for people on the outside. People on the inside have a religious right to practice their faith. People on the outside don't have a right to go into prison. In fact, as a chaplain, I can tell you that there's always people beating on the door. Every cult, every nutcase out there wanted in, and often as a chaplain, if I, you know, they would be calling saying, you know, God has led me to, you know, come to your prison and start a ministry. And I go, well, thank you so much. We'll be in touch. You know, but I didn't want them in the prison at all, unless one of the men. And it didn't matter. You know, I was responsible for their religious freedom. And so if a man came to me and said, you know, I'm Moorish Science Temple of America, and I want to practice my religion, I'd go, great, you know, we'll make sure your religious preference is that. And then I start calling places like Chicago and seeing if there's somebody who's willing to fly to come in and visit somebody. So if it comes from the inside, it's their right. And if someone is Eastern Orthodox on the inside, then the chaplain has a responsibility. It's his constitutional right to practice his religion. So that's the key, really, is from the inside. So if you're aware, you know, of someone in prison from one of your parishes, or maybe a family member that's in prison, then they can be the one to get you started inside. So that's my advice on it.
Yes. Well, that's kind of a catch-22. If you know someone's in prison but, you know, can't really contact them, or you contact the warden, or how do you, to, you know, see if they're interested?
Well, usually, I mean, they're being contacted by someone, their family. You know, they have letters or phone calls or in-person visits. And because it's really up to the person, the person in prison may not want Orthodox services. He may not want to see a priest, and that's his choice. But if he does, if the family goes to visit Johnny in prison, and they say, Johnny, you know, our church were willing to start a program for you here. If you would like it, talk to your chaplain about wanting to practice your faith, and make sure that you're listed as Eastern Orthodox. And then that will get things started.
But do we know if there are any chaplains in any prisons in Michigan? Are there any chaplains?
Orthodox?
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of. Not that I'm aware of. But they don't have to be Orthodox. They just need to do their job. You know, that's their job. I always viewed it as a chaplain, I had my job and I had my ministry. If I did my job well, which was taking care of all the religious rites in the prison, then I could have a ministry. If I didn't do my job, then I wouldn't have a ministry, because I'd be answering grievances and lawsuits all the time. So I really tried to make sure I did my job well, and then it freed me up to have a ministry in there as well. Yes, sir?
Father Stevens, I missed the beginning of your presentation, so I just wanted to try and understand how OCPM work in terms of, you work with local congregations, and then they may have established some sort of contact with a local correctional facility, and then you provide support for what's, I just want to have a better understanding of the model.
Well, it's multifaceted, really. You know, we exist, and the more we get the word out, the more people in prison find out about us, and they write us. And as they write us, then we correspond back with them. We have correspondence studies. You know, they get certificates for completing these things. They can write, get personal letters back from OCPM. And then if they're telling us, like, you know, hey, how do I get a service started here? Then we call the nearest parish, and we try to assist that parish with getting into that prison because someone on the inside requested it. And so, you know, oftentimes as word gets out, we have priests already doing the work. There are priests going into prisons, and when we find out, I always call them and I say, what do you need? You know, we'll send you Bibles, we'll send you study material, icons. What do you need? We'll help you with that. And
do you have local chapters nationwide?
You know, and we're kind of the baby on the block here. We're one of the newest under the Assembly of Bishops, and although we were the first recognized by the Assembly of Bishops, we're still kind of the youngest. And IOCC and OCMC are much more well established. So that's something we're working on, but we haven't gotten that far yet. We're still just trying. To be honest, most places I go, people go, I didn't know there was such a thing as an Orthodox prison ministry. And so we're still fighting that battle of just getting known out there.
You know. That is a goal that you...
Eventually, that's what we'd like to do, is set up basically regions and find priests that are really involved and ask them if they would kind of be the regional go-to person. We've got that down in the southeast. I've got a priest that anything going on in his area, I call him and have him help direct me as to who would be a good choice to call to get into the prison and things like that. So we're working on it. There's so much to do. And right now, our staff, we've got two people that do the correspondence. I've got one person who's the operations director in New York, and me. That's it.
You probably reviewed this, but how do individuals get involved?
Well, again, there's a number of ways. Setting things up like this are helpful just to get the word out and get involved that way. The correspondence program, we're getting people involved more and more. That's beginning to take off. People get involved. One church, they just want to do fundraisers. And they'll have bake sales, and whatever they can do to help raise money. Because, like I said before, everything we send for free. And so that's a lot of costs. And so we have that. And then getting involved in other aspects, you know, maybe trying to get a team together. Usually, we try not to get the cart before the horse kind of thing. We try to get, if we know an area where we have people in prison, then we try to get a team going and get a clergy involved, a priest or a deacon involved, that we can tie to a chaplain. We've been very successful, like in Indiana. They didn't even recognize Orthodoxy. And I think I was telling the clergy earlier, they didn't recognize Orthodoxy at all. And just by happenstance, I happened to have lunch with a guy who asked me if I would be the guest speaker for the governor's prayer breakfast. And the governor invited all the state chaplains to come, including the director of chaplaincy. And there were like 650 politicians, and they asked me to speak for a half hour. And afterwards, Orthodoxy was recognized. And it's really taken off well there. So.
Father, this might be a good lead-in. First of all, there's sign-up sheets that make sure you signed in, or if you need a sign-up sheet. And we have a group that's been meeting here at Holy Transfiguration. We don't mean it to be a Holy Transfiguration group. It's open to everyone, anyone who's interested, or geographically, you know, if you want to have your own group, you know, that's fine. We don't feel it's in competition, but you know, make sure we have your email address and phone number. We'll try to stay in touch and, you know, hear your ideas as we go forward.
Yeah. I wish I could say, hey, I'm going to sign you up right now and here's what you're going to be doing, but we're evolving. And as we evolve, then, you know, things will take shape. And that's what we're doing right now. Yes.
Yeah, so the group here, we have discussed a couple of entries into prison besides the idea of correspondence. And that is working with other groups like Prison Fellowship is willing probably to help us get in with them to go into prisons. I know we've also talked to a Catholic, Roman Catholic deacon about that. What do you think of that approach to be into and actually having contact with the prisoners?
Well, I mean, there are groups doing that across the United States, that there are groups doing that, and that's one possibility. One of the things that I've observed in prison is there's a lot of confusion about Christian groups, and the men don't know Orthodoxy from, you know, the wildest Pentecostal group coming in. I would like to see us have groups that are Orthodox so that the men understand there's a difference, that we're not just one of many Protestant groups coming in, but that we are Orthodox. To come in under Prison Fellowship, I love Prison Fellowship. They do a great job. They're very Orthodox friendly. We always have gone to their national or international convocation, and they invite Orthodox from around the world to it. And they're very, very friendly to Orthodox, gave us our own space, let us have our own convocation at the same time, and so they're a very good group. My concern is just that there would be that confusion for the men, that they would just think of Orthodoxy as just another Protestant group, and they would never see the difference. And if you're in with a Protestant group, obviously you can't very well be proclaiming your difference, you know, that wouldn't be appropriate. So I hope that answers your question. I was trying to be delicate with it. Other questions or anything? Yes?
Two questions. You were saying some parishes, people say they don't want anything to do with that type of person. Do you have any success in changing the hearts of people at parishes?
I think things like this help so that they begin to realize that Christ does transform lives. That sometimes they've watched too many prison movies, I think, and they have it in their heart already that they don't want anything to do with those kind of people, not realizing that, you know, it's the little Johnnies that end up being in prison. I can tell you one story. There was one prison, and if this is on the videotape, I hope the priest doesn't see it, but there was one prison where we had several Orthodox men in a prison, and the chaplain was actually calling me, saying, you know, I really need an Orthodox priest. I called the nearest church, and the priest said, I don't want anything to do with that. I go, well, these guys are already Orthodox. I mean, these are Orthodox men who desperately need help. They need to grow in their faith. Find somebody else. Well, there's really not anybody else around. And so I said, okay, well, thank you very much. And so I called his bishop. And I said, here's the story. And he goes, don't worry, I'll take care of it. So I happened to be passing through that area once, and I called him up, and I said, hey, you want to go to lunch? And I said, so tell me what happened. I'm so glad you're involved in this prison ministry. He goes, yeah, he goes, it was the funniest thing. My bishop called me and said, there's a prison down the road with several Orthodox in it. I want you to go there. And he said, this was his words. He goes, I told the bishop I'd think about it. And he said, think? No. This isn't an option. I'm telling you, go get cleared for that prison and go in there. And he was enjoying it. I never told him that I was the snitch. You know, I didn't, I'm used to snitches in prison get treated really bad. So I didn't. But you know, I get frustrated sometimes, you know, because it's hard. It's hard, you know, when we see the need, and here you are, this group wants to go, and then I've got a prison that's right there with several Orthodox in it that are begging for a priest to come. It gets frustrating at times. So,
yeah. Do you have, when you speak in front of the governor, or like elected officials, do they if you had a recommendation, like a mission, there's an article in the paper almost every day about the prison food being contracted out, mm-hmm. and they're getting